So you know we're in a series on covenant. So last term we looked at the details of a covenant, what covenant means, what covenants we find in the Bible. And this term we're looking at kind of how that relates to us, what the implications are for us practically and I guess theologically as well in some ways. So today we're looking at covenant and marriage. It's not all about marriage in practice. It's been between two people. So if you're not married, don't switch off. That's not the focus. There's a bit of that, but that isn't the whole talk. So, yeah, don't worry. So why is marriage a covenant? Because when we get married, we have a marriage contract, potentially. That's a legal agreement. It picks up, they could be very different from country to country. The content and the form might be different. It's totally what makes our marriages recognized in law in our country. But a covenant is an exchange of persons. It's intended to form a kinship. If we look back biblically, it's intended to form a kinship between people. It's not based on a paper agreement where the people might not even need to be present. It's actually a connection of two people. And it also involves an oath, which brings God right into the center of that agreement. So that makes it different from a contract. I'm going to talk a little bit more about oath later, but not now. When Alice talked about covenant right at the beginning of our series, she drew out the elements that are important in a contract, what involves. So it includes protecting one another, sharing resources, giving each other a sign that show other people that we're in a covenant relationship with that person, having a sacrifice to seal the covenant, and then sharing a celebratory meal. Do we see those things in our marriage ceremonies, celebrations today? Yeah, we do. I'm not quite sure we see the sacrifice. Although I did read somewhere that actually the giving of receiving of rings was also meant to symbolize the sacrificing of worldly wealth for the sake of relationship. But I don't remember any blood being involved in our marriage ceremonies. But they are there. They pick up those elements of covenant. But I'm going to take us back to what would have been the traditions, really well-known, common, everybody did, traditions of Jewish marriage ceremonies at the time of Jesus. Now, remember, this is before the New Testament is written, but this would have been what was expected of the establishment of a marriage at the time. So, the arrangement of who the bride, and I want you to listen and see if you think hear anything that kind of rings bells. I'm going to get you to talk to each other afterwards. So the arrangement of who the bride would be was made by the father of the groom and the father of the bride. But the father of the groom actually makes the choice. The bride and the groom did get an okay. They could say no if they wanted to, but the father made the arrangement. The groom then made a journey to the father of the bride's house where he would make the agreement. Terms and conditions were agreed. The groom paid the bride price. There was also a dowry paid by the father for the bride. Obligations and responsibilities on all parties were laid out. The groom left gifts with the bride to remember him by when he was going to be gone again after the agreement was made. Then the betrothal happens. At the time of the betrothal, there is a ritual immersion in water to represent spiritual cleansing. Vows are said, rings are engaged, a glass of wine is shared, and then there's a feast. At that point, the couple are legally married, but they don't live together. The groom goes away for a period of at least 9 months, 12 months, 2 years. And he goes away to prepare a place to bring his bride to live in together after the marriage. During that same period of time, the bride is supposed to consecrate herself. She is supposed to examine every area of her life and make changes so that she's ready for married life in future. She also does some things like making a dress and make preparations for beautifying herself on the day of the wedding. The wedding date is not set. Neither the bride nor the groom know when the wedding will be. And there's a phrase, the groom's phrase is, no man knows except my father. So neither of them know. The bride's household live in constant expectancy after the sort of kind of 12 months-ish when they'd expected to be. They have this constant expectancy that today might be the day, so they light lamps in the evening because the groom traditionally comes in the evening, and they just wait and wait and wait for the time when it will happen, but they don't know when it will be. The groom also doesn't know, but eventually the father gives the okay, go. At that point, the groom sets off from his house to make the journey to the bride's house to collect her. The groomsmen go in front of him, shouting, "Behold, the bridegroom comes," and blowing a trumpet. He collects the bride, brings her back to his father's house, and there's a small marriage ceremony. It's done under a special canopy that I can't pronounce the name of. Vows are exchanged and a cup of wine is shared. And then the feast and celebration start. That's when all the guests come. It lasts for 7 days and seven nights. It is intended to honour the groom. And guests are supposed to write a poem or sing a song for him. The groom is then supposed to display the beauty and grace of his bride. So she puts on her beautiful clothes and to much the admiration of respect of everybody. So I want you to turn to your neighbour and just have a minute of saying, what things jumped to your mind? What did it remind you of? Just turn around, have a minute. So can I gather you together again? We could go point by point through those things, couldn't we? Where did you see your, what were the bits of things that jumped out of you and said, oh, that reminds me of this? Okay, come on, there's an obvious prompt, right? Baptism. There are so many bits. Some of those things are still in Jewish ceremonies and marriage ceremonies today. Not all of them. They've developed different traditions over time. But there are so many bits of things here, and I think it's amazing that God cleverly draws from, and we don't know which, draws from human experience to help us understand things of him, but he also inspires human traditions to reveal himself through us. Now, we don't know how those traditions grew. You know, did God inspire them right at the beginning? They've been carried on a long time. Or did he just draw from that and then reveal to John in Revelation that this was a helpful picture? We don't know. And actually, it doesn't matter. It's just really clever how God, you know, connects together with people in that way and establishes things that help to reveal himself and his plans to us in a way that we can understand. We have the groom visiting the bride. Jesus came. The terms were established. The price was paid by Jesus. The bride price was paid. We have ritual cleansing in baptism. A cup of wine is shared that we still do today. And do we have a gift left until the groom comes back? Yeah, we have the Spirit. So all of those things are kind of represented in what we have. And there would be a lot more in that you could go away and then think about. We haven't got time to do that now. So that's one of those things I want to send you away. Hence, it doesn't matter if you're married or not. Go away and think about some of those things, maybe a little bit more deeply. So God initiated marriage. Right back in Genesis 2, we have reference to the word wife and God bringing man and woman together, or two people together. And then it's all the way through to Revelation, the end of times. The marriage is reflected again. So I think God weaves through the concept of marriage right from the beginning to the end and all the way through human stories in between. And who knows into the future? We don't know what that will look like and how the marriage of the Lamb and the Bride of Christ. We don't know quite what the implications will be for us and what that will feel like, look like, but it's still there. Because it's established in that point of the fact that God is a relational God. He's a Trinity in and of himself. Therefore, relationship is a key part of who he is. And love, as expressed through the joining together in relationship, is part of what God means by that. And we are a reflection of God's glory. Therefore, our marriages should also be a display of his glory. Which means that maybe we want to have a little bit of focus on our marriages occasionally and make sure that they do reflect God's glory. So I'm going to do a few bits of things that look, I'm not going to do something that you can do in marriage course. That's not what I'm going to do. There were so many pointers I could tell you if you're married, but that's not what we're going to do because I don't think that's helpful today. So Genesis 2, 24 to 25 says, that is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. I think that last little bit, and they felt no shame, is an important bit of what God planned from the beginning. That's that original design bit of that actually two people together shouldn't feel shame. I think it speaks to our openness and honesty in marriage and that we should be upright and gracious with each other. We probably aren't always all of those things in our married relationships, but it is what we should be. But the most important bit is that we should never be making the other person feel ashamed. And I think probably sometimes we do. We promise at the beginning to love each other. A covenant means to protect each other, to share those things that are the deepest part, but to do it in a way that actually is for the good of the other person. And I think sometimes we fail in that one. You know, we don't want to pass on a sense of disapproval between two people, but we do, because we're flawed. Both of us are flawed. We can't say one person is more flawed than the other. We're both flawed. But it does mean we need to watch our words when we're stressed or when we're tired or when we're hurt or when the other person has disapproved of us and made us feel ashamed. We shouldn't reflect it back again. That's part of reflecting that fact that we're in a covenant relationship with God. We're under the new covenant, and that's unconditional love. We need to recognize it, and we need to try and emulate unconditional love, not just in our marriage relationships, but in our community and to outside as well. Now, apparently, I am not perfect. You might be, but apparently I am not. I apparently have a few flaws. You could ask my husband. I think maybe he might have one or two as well. In fact, he might have one or two that he knows about, and I suspect he might have one or two more that he hasn't yet recognized. Now, that's one of those areas where, what should I do? Should I just ignore his flaws and just live with them and be gracious? Should I nag him about them? Should I try and change him? What should I do? Well, I think maybe we could, or maybe I should just cover over those areas. Maybe I should pick up those areas where his weaknesses are so that they never come to light. I could try all kinds of those things, but I think maybe we could look at what God says in terms of forgiving and protecting and covering over. But actually, he doesn't want us to stay in that place where we have flaws, either of us. But I think sometimes we tiptoe around in marriage relationships, or we nag, or we gossip, or whatever. And I read something that I found much more helpful, which was, rather than trying to ignore those areas where there's a weakness or something that's still a journey of transformation that needs to happen or working around it, that actually if we take it in prayer with humility, because our understanding of their flaw is probably not the fullness of that understanding, but if we take that faithfully and humbly in prayer to God and allow his transformation to happen, not my view of what should happen, but his view to happen, then actually that's a really loving and invested thing to do. We can do the same thing with our children. And this came out of something. So this is a little book that my prayer partner years ago gave me. So there's memory verses in one bit. But in the back, this is something I'd read somewhere else, that there's a card. I put a card in here with people on, and maybe something I'm praying for them. But those people who are closest to you can maybe identify a verse that would be the restoration of that area where you see a flaw or a challenge, and pray that for them. So you're not praying out of your, I want this to happen and this to change, but you're praying about the fullness of something God says for that person. So you're not focusing on the flaw, you're focusing on the good and praying that faithfully for them. Then you might want to pray some other good things as well underneath. But actually, praying those things, and if you have more than one or two flaws, don't put them all on a big card or a lot of cards. Just put one at a time and pray for that one. And then when that one's moved on, replace it with another one. Because actually that sees God answering and changing that transformation, because that's what God wants for people. He wants transformation in that person and you and in your marriage and then in the relationships that you touch. So that's my first. Pray about the flaw areas. Covenant keeping in marriage relationship this way can be impacted by your relationship this way. So if you are not investing in your covenant relationship between you and God, that could have an impact this way. If you are, it will have a positive impact this way. Now, I recognize that some people are married to someone who doesn't believe. That doesn't matter. This relationship still has a positive impact here. And if you neglect this, it will still have a negative here. So therefore, investing in that is important. Disconnectedness from God will have an impact on your other relationships. Now, sometimes when we're in, when we get busy in life and we're in the midst of relationship and family and children or study or whatever, it's quite hard to find time. We don't prioritize. But I think sometimes we need to intentionally sit down and look at our diaries and our priorities and working out, are we giving it the time and space individually, but together? Are you giving the other person time and space to pursue that in the way that they need to? Remembering that they don't need the same that you do as you do. Extroverts need different things in their spiritual life than an introvert does. A person who loves nature connects best with God outside. So if you want to stay inside with them all the time, that is not helping their spiritual connection with God. So you need to allow space for the right way of connecting. Our life group a couple of years ago used this book. It's called Sacred Pathways, and it looks at different ways that people connect best with God and finding your best way and making space for it. Because if you've done always what other people have done or your church has suggested, you might be missing a trick on what's best for you. So make sure you invest in that. Ephesians 5:32. Actually, if someone who's got more hands, can someone just find me Ephesians 5:32 and read it out of the one of the church Bibles?
Ephesians 5:32. This is a great mystery, but it's an illustration of the way. Okay. As the scripture says, a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife, and the two are united into one. This is a great mystery, but it is an illustration of the way Christ and the church are one.
So as we said before, you've got this reflection of God bringing two people together that reflects the bigger picture of God connecting his church and Christ together. But it says that actually that's a mystery. And I think not only is the bigger picture, the revelation picture, a mystery, but I think the coming together of two people is quite a mystery as well. I certainly don't feel like I understand it, and I certainly don't feel I walk it very well all of the time. But actually that word mystery is also connected in places with the word oath. Because I don't think we all fully understand what the strength of an oath means. There's another word in the Bible that's often connected with oath as well. And that word, I'm not going to pronounce it, brings the meaning of casting out of spirits and evil influence. That's what that oath and mystery connection brings. And if you think about it, when you swear an oath, what do? You often have to put your hand up. Why? Because the reason originally was that in that you are asking for and invoking the help of God to fulfill the pledge that you are making. So that's that bringing God into the center of your relationship, in that covenant relationship. We're asking God to help in the marriage, you know, the marriage promises that we're making. But I think we often forget that. We forget that we've asked God into the center and to help in that place. We do it out of our own strength or the advice that we can get or copying other people or working hard on ourselves or nagging the other person. Actually, we need to remember that actually the strength in this relationship is here. And the strength in our society in terms of a bedrock of stable family life, where there is family life, is based on that strength of God at the center of holding relationships together. That's what we can bring to our society where there is brokenness. So are you praying for your marriage? Are you bringing the full strength of God into the center of that? But are you praying for other people's marriages? I have to be honest and say only occasionally. It's not something that's top of my thinking a lot of the time, but maybe we should be more intentional about praying for other people's marriages, particularly praying for marriages outside of the church, where they just don't have the same strength of people supporting them, the same accountability, the same help of God that they recognize at the center of bringing that together. Maybe we can be more of an impact in society. How can we help and support? The place, that canopy, where they make the marriage vows had intentionally open sides. The whole point of it was to demonstrate right from the start that open-hearted hospitality, to invite people in, to have a transparency to see what marriage relationship, what the union between two people with God at the center could be, and how that could have a positive impact on those around them. It was also intended, however, to be viewed in from outside so that the people in the center could benefit from that extra perspective. Because when we're in the middle of it, we can't always see the issues that might be arising. So allowing people to speak into your family, your relationship in a positive way is also part of it. Now, I'm not saying we all carry responsibility for everyone else's relationships. That's not what I'm saying at all. But there's a balance of openness and transparency, as well as witness outwards and inviting people into positive relationship. It's not about judgment. It's not about all of those things. Huh. And I am where I thought I was. So marriage is not a one-to-one thing. And in societies that are more community-based, marriage is part of the community. It kind of makes up the community. In our Western society, we've become more closed behind our little doors and our family unit. Our marriage is a private thing. But actually, I don't think I see that in the Bible. I think I see that in what God says to us. And we have to find our balance that's appropriate for our time and place in history and the world. But maybe it's something we want to have a little bit of a look at. And it's that place of where we are all a gift to each other. So let's go back to that broader view. We are all part of this marriage dance. In effect, we're at the point that the betrothal has happened of the church to Christ, but the marriage hasn't yet happened. So we're in that point of consecration. We're at that point of reflecting on ourselves and who we are and preparing ourselves for that, building the strength of our relationships. So singularly and corporately, we can be a bride. We reflect that in our marriages. We reflect that in society, but we reflect that spiritually as well. But when we're involved in a dance, we can't just do our own thing. We have to listen to the rhythm and the speed of the music, not just one or the other. We need to have our eyes open to where other people in the room are in relation to us when we're in a dance. We need to follow any set steps if there aren't any, otherwise you would be over here doing your own thing. We need to invite others to the dance because you're not going to do it by yourself, it's a set dance. And you need to enjoy it. What does that mean for your marriages? What does that mean for our church? What does that mean for us as the bride of Christ today? I nearly played you a clip of music at the end, but I think you probably will know it already, so I'm not going to. You know the Frank Sinatra song, yes? I Did It My Way. I think we might need to change the words for marriage. I think actually it should be that we did it God's way. Because I don't think we can do marriage on our own, but I don't think we can do church and being the bride of Christ on our own either. So maybe if we keep that in mind, that might be helpful. We've left it intentionally to finish early so that there's a bit of space. Rob's going to come and play some music so you can have a bit of a reflection on what does that mean for you? What do you want to take away? What do you want to do with any of that? And then Chris will pray for us at the end.